It's a nightmare. Heavy footsteps behind you, huge hands snaking around your neck. Or maybe it's the feel of cool breath, the scraping of sharpened teeth. This Halloween, let's go back to the beginning. Come along as we visit two of the world's most famous monsters and their creators.
Welcome to You Totally Made That Up. We are a history podcast that tells you the wildest, craziest, nuttiest stories from yesteryear, ones that sound like somebody must have totally made them up. But they're all true, and we especially like the ones that have supernatural, paranormal, woo-woo elements, so those parts may only be true to the people who live them. We don't go for the lore says or the legend goes, though. We want dates and names and all the facts that we can find. And I am Nash.
And I am Tiff.
We are your hosts. This is part two of the Halloween stories, so if you haven't listened to part one yet, highly recommend you check that out when you can. But for now, let's just jump right into Tiff's story of Bram Stoker and Dracula. It was a dark and stormy night.
Dark and stormy. So, let's summarize Dracula. I felt really bad trying to, like, summarize it, or I'm like, after not reading it, or I'm like, is this important?
Well, and when I read over it, I was shocked. I didn't know how many liberties or if he took any at all. Seems like Francis Ford Coppola really did not take much liberty. It seems like when he said he's making Bram Stoker's Dracula, seems like he pretty much did.
Yeah, from what I can remember. I haven't seen that movie in so long.
It's so good. I mean, listen. I have a deep and abiding love for Keanu Reeves. Like, it's so deep. When I found out he was in a relationship, I was happy. Both times. You know, way back and currently, I'm genuinely happy for him. Like, it's my love for that man runs so deep. Let me tell you this, though. He is the type of actor, and many of us are this way with the various jobs we've all had. When he nails it, he fucking knocks it out of the park. Case in point, Ted in Bill and Ted nails it. Cannot imagine anybody else in that role.
Yeah.
Second case in point, John Wick. I cannot imagine anybody else in that role.
Uh-huh.
But in Bram Stoker's Dracula, he gave it his all. I've never seen somebody try so hard to do such a bad accent. Well, yes, I have. I take it back. Every actor who's ever done a Southern accent, including national native Reese Witherspoon, shockingly, everybody who's tried to do, and all I want these vocal coaches, whatever they're paying them, these specifically the regional dialect coach for the South, whoever that person is, because it's got to be one person because everybody's doing the same things wrong.
Uh-huh.
All I want them to do is watch 9 to 5 or Rhinestone with Dolly Parton. Study it, or Steel Magnolias, Dolly Parton.
Let Dolly be your guide.
Dolly is the guide. That's all they've got to, or me. I'll take your money. Send me your scripts, and I'll read different inflections and variations on every line of dialogue that you have. I'll let my Alabama emerge just a little bit more than I do on the podcast. See, there you go. There you go. I'll let it loose a little bit more, and I'll take your money. But until that time comes, Dolly Parton in the aforementioned movies. What I'm saying is there's a lot more, I guess, subtlety to it, perhaps. And we're not split into two distinct groups of we're either out on the veranda with our mint juleps or we're backwoods redneck cousin fuckers. But Keanu, he tries so hard. So hard, and it's so bad. But I digressed. What were you about to say? You were about to do something about this book.
Well, I was going to try and summarize it so that everybody kind of knew what I was going to be talking about and, you know, make sure we're all on the same page.
That's a great idea. I support it. Yes.
All right. Well, I mean, we can always get back to Keanu at some point.
I can talk for days.
I mean, you know, we don't have to end there, but back to...
No, but as we all know, I'm gunning for a Skarsgård so that I can move to Sweden. Because that's my end game. That's my end game.
You've got a plan. You got to stick with it.
That's right.
But hey, Dracula. It's a story that's told as a series of letters, diary entries, newspaper articles, ship's log kind of stuff. It takes place within, you know, about 6 months throughout this year. And it starts with Jonathan Harker, played by Keanu Reeves. And so he is an English solicitor, and he goes to assist Count Dracula at his castle in the Carpathians. And it's for a real estate transaction. Once he gets there, he kind of realizes that things are not cool. I don't know how else to really say it. He's just kind of like, okay, I guess this guy is a vampire. And Dracula leaves him there and heads on a ship to England because he's trying to move to a new society. In the meantime, Harker's fiance, Mina, is with her friend Lucy. Lucy's super popular. She's got like this gaggle of suitors. And then we end up finding out that Dracula is stalking Lucy. She did choose a fiance, but they all stay best friends. They're like a little Scooby gang. As time passes, she starts to suffer from various episodes with sleepwalking, memory loss, and she starts to kind of waste away. At this point, we're introduced to Abraham Van Helsing, and he figures out what's going on with Lucy. So he tries to protect her. Doesn't go very well. They're attacked by a wolf. Lucy's mom dies, and Lucy ends up with two puncture marks on her neck. Now, she does die, quotes there, and it turns out that she has become a vampire. Van Helsing gathers the Scooby Gang. They try to track her down, and they do end up dealing with her. They discover that Dracula is behind all of this, and they start chasing him. He also ends up attacking Mina, and ends up having like blood control over her. There's like a psychic connection to Dracula. He leaves back to his castle in Transylvania in the Carpathians. They again pursue him using the psychic connection with Mina. They end up discovering that he's transported by gypsies. They converge on the caravan and Harker shears Dracula. Hey, spoilers. Gets him through the throat and Dracula crumbles to dust. There's basically what happens with Dracula. Don't quote me for any book reports, though, because that was a really terrible summary. But now you know. So yeah, we know that vampires are not new. There have been vampiric creatures and legends for thousands of years. In ancient Mesopotamia, they had stories of blood-drinking demons. The Persians were one of the first civilizations to have tales of these kinds of monsters and creatures attempting to drink blood from men actually depicted on excavated pottery shards. There are vampiric creatures within Greek, Indian, and Jewish traditions. In West Africa, the Ashanti people have an iron-toothed and tree-dwelling vampire. There's a type of vampire from the Philippines that can detach its upper half. There's a blood-sucking undead creature from China. So there are so many different variations on vampires all throughout the world, through all cultures. There are lots of different variations, of course, with all of those of how the vampires come to be, depending on the folklore of the region in question. I'm kind of just doing a quick glance over of all of this because there's so much vampire lore and so many different stories that I'm sure will be covered. You'll get a deep dive on some aspect of this in another episode. Okay, but in Slavic and Chinese traditions, any corpse that was jumped over by an animal, particularly a dog or a cat, was feared to become one of the undead. A body with a wound that had not been treated with boiling water was also at risk of becoming a vampire. In Russian folklore, vampires were said to have once been witches or people who had rebelled against the Orthodox Church, and they came back because of dark magic. Ooh. More recent lore, we've got vampires creating more vampires with bites and human blood. And then there's also sorcery, committing suicide, contagion. People believe that babies born with teeth or born on Christmas or between Christmas and Epiphany, aka Three Kings Day or January 6th, were also more likely to become vampires. So, I don't know, maybe your chances are good based on any one of those options. Now, modern vampires mostly are credited back to Dracula. And, of course, lots of smart people like to point out that Dracula was based on the real historical figure Vlad III, or Vlad the Impaler. And how things got there end up pretty interesting. So let's begin with the author. Abraham Stoker, better known as Bram, was born November 8, 1847, in Dublin, Ireland, just after the start of the Great Potato Famine. So that's a really great time to be born. Lucky him. For the first 7 years of his life, he was bedridden with an undisclosed issue. And a lot of people say that it was never diagnosed, but that seems pretty unlikely because of, you know, different... He was never really outward with all of his symptoms, with all of his issues. So it seems like he might have known what was going on, but just was like, it was never really said and just kind of kept it to himself.
Well, it's nobody's business, you know?
Yeah, yeah. But as the famine was going on, the family continued to grow. They decided to move closer to the sea because, you know, the sea heals. We've already talked about this. And so they moved to a seaside town, which was also a popular spot for lots of outlaws and thieves to try and hide along the shore, who, when caught, would be hung and left to rot for several days in the gallows. They also had a plot nearby that was reserved specifically for suicides, who would then be staked to try to prevent their unhappy spirits from wandering. In this area, Bram would hear stories about the legend of a phantom horseman. His mother also liked to tell him a lot of stories. She told him that she heard a banshee when her mother had died. She liked to talk about how the family survived the famine, including by drinking blood from the family cow. And then she had lots of personal stories from surviving the cholera epidemic of 1832. So this guy's living the life as a kid, really.
Well, and Mama's a tough broad. Wow.
Hell yeah. Now, as he gets older, for his career, his career is actually, if you look him up, the Wikipedia page, of course, says he's a novelist. But he was a theater manager and assistant. But obviously, he liked to write. Some of his friends and his contemporaries included Oscar Wilde, William Butler Yeats, and friend of the show, our favorite, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
This episode is so name-droppy. I love it. I love it.
Right? All right. So as far as Doyle, buddy, we're going to come back to you in just a second. Now, it's important to know that when Dracula was published in 1897, it was not even close to the first published vampire story. And you did drop a little bit about that. So the first major account of vampires that kind of stormed through Europe was actually in the 1730s. Prior to this, they weren't well known or of much concern outside of some regional beliefs. And this is because the Treaty of Passerowitz in 1718 had the region known as the Balkans ceded to the Habsburgs from the Ottoman Empire. So now they join up with a lot of the other European countries and they start to share a lot of their folklore and traditions, which included stories of vampires, and they melded with stories of witchcraft, which we already know had been circulating through Europe for quite a while.
And by the way, the Habsburgs, we've talked about them too. Y'all go, it's an early episode, but...
Oh yeah, things really, really kind of... It's...
This time period. Guys. Yeah, this time period was... Ooh. God almighty. Okay, carry
it's
on.
It's rich. It is a treasure trove. All right, so things really kicked off with this after a gentleman named Arnold Pohl died. Before his death, he claimed that he had been attacked by a vampire. Now, he did try to protect himself by eating some of the grave dirt and cleaning the wound with the blood of said vampire.
As you do. As you do.
As you do. I'm not saying that's where he went wrong. He still ended up dying. I don't know, guys. And a few weeks later, he was allegedly seen out and about. When they went into his grave, they said that he looked like he was freshly dead, not having any issues, although he had been in the ground for 40 days. So they ended up staking him, and according to accounts, he bled and he groaned, which helped to confirm, yep, he was a vampire. Then in 1731, there were 17 deaths during a three-month period, which were all attributed to vampires. The townspeople were dealing with it because they were like, yeah, this happens. But word got out to the Austrian emperor, who assigned Johann Flückinger to go and check it out. He had been a field surgeon. He was pretty high ranking. So he was sent out there to get to work and find out what the hell is going on. He ended up having the townspeople dig up about 40 bodies to examine them and found that 17 were in similar states to old Arnold. Now, he ended up writing all of this up, kind of telling the tale about what he found, what was all going on, some of the characteristics of the bodies, and this ended up being circulated, which caused some vampire panic. Now, eventually, the church got involved. There were theories that this was all due to premature burials, that there was a plague, that there was rabies. And it is worth noting that there was a major rabies epidemic between 1721 and 1728.
Aha! Aha! says Nash.
Aha! But this really was the first wave of vampire hysteria to rush through Europe. It's notable that in some Slavic accounts, there's actually no distinction between vampires and what we would now call werewolves. In some versions, a vampire was simply what a werewolf became after they died. I don't know, the lore just gets crazy. It's just so mixed up. But that kind of ties in with some of the rabies issues and rabies thoughts as far as what could have caused what was happening during that time. All right, now we jump ahead to The Vampire by John Polidori. Told you we were coming back to it. So according to my...
Hey, and by the way, vampire with a Y?
Yeah, vampire with a Y. He's edgy.
What an edgelord.
So he was Lord Byron's physician and lover, and he ended up writing the story because he used discarded notes from Byron. So that's where it wasn't necessarily that, John came up with it. Lord Byron started it and was like, yeah, I'm not really feeling the story. And John was like, well, I could maybe do something with that. And Byron's like, yeah, knock yourself out. Have fun. And so it became the first English language vampire story published in April of 1819.
Oh, my stars. Polidori, you piece of shit.
Polidori.
Polidori, the somewhat plagiarizer.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, good. Because otherwise we'd have shitty skeleton woman story.
Yeah. Yeah. But no, we got edgy vampire. After this time, a little bit of a vampire craze. We've got operettas, there's stage plays, the penny dreadful serial novels that are becoming popular. This is now the 1840s. The most popular of these was called Varney the Vampire, or The Feast of Blood. When this got compiled into a single novel in 1847, it ran 876 double-columned pages, had 232 chapters, and is like 667,000 words. It sounds like a nightmare, to be honest. Apparently the story is not very good. But we do have some of the vampire tropes that originated with Varney. He's got the fangs. He's got the two puncture wounds on the necks of the victims. Comes through the window to attack a sleeping maiden. Hypnotic powers and superhuman strength. And then this trickles down to the next significant vampire story, which is Carmilla. This was published in 1871 by Irish author Joseph Sheridan Le Fanu, and it's noted in several sources to be the most important inspiration for Dracula. Carmilla is lesser known, and it's a lot shorter, but there are some similarities between Carmilla and Dracula. And I'm quoting here. Both stories are told in the first person. Both authors indulge the air of mystery by allowing the characters to solve the enigma of the vampire along with the reader. The descriptions of the title character in Carmilla and of Lucy in Dracula are very similar, and both women sleepwalk. And Stoker's Dr. Abraham Van Helsing is similar to Le Fanu's vampire expert Baron Vordenburg. There are symptoms described in Carmilla and Dracula that are both very comparable.
I mean, kind of sounds more than comparable. It kind of sounds a bit like a rip.
Yeah.
I mean, not totally. I know that Dracula's a very complex novel, and he did it right. I mean, it's a great book, but do you know what I'm saying? Like, that sounds a little more than homage, let's say.
Yeah. And that was actually a thing that was going on a lot at the time. I'll explain a little bit more of that in a second. Now, we've got these books. We've got the little bit of vampire history from the 1700s. Additionally, there is some Gaelic lore about vampires or vampire-like creatures. So there's the Dárag Dua, which is the red bloodsucker. She's a female vampire-like creature who is said to tempt men with her beauty and then suck their blood. Now, her backstory is that she was this incredibly beautiful, just amazing young lady. She was in love with the neighboring farm boy, but her father was like, I can do something. I can make some money off of this because everybody wants you. He ended up committing her to a cruel chieftain in an arranged marriage. Of course, he was terrible to her, and she just was like, okay, well, I'm just going to go ahead and wither away. And she did. She like literally just stopped eating, stopped drinking. Her husband remarried before she was even cold. She came back a year later to seek revenge. She ended up sucking the life force out of her father, and then she went to her husband, and she went so far as to drain him of all of his blood, and that ignited her bloodlust. She sounds pretty awesome to me.
She's fun at parties.
There were stories of Irish fairies who were bloodless and would abduct children for their blood.
P.S. Those are mosquitoes. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So Stoker, he's got all of these works that he could reference. Kind of these are contemporary stories. We don't know for sure about the Gaelic lore. If, you know, that was something that would have been told from his mother, she'd like to tell him stories. But he was also into the occult. We're talking astral projections, alchemy, Egyptology, Babylonian lore, phrenology. It was rumored, there's never been anything that's confirmed this, but it's rumored that he was a member of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. And then, of course, you know, we've got his friend and actually distant relative, our favorite smart idiot, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. And we all know how he feels about things. We know.
And refer to the fairy episode.
Yes.
And I also refer you to the episode about Houdini. Just scroll through the episodes and look for the Houdini mention. And then even further back is the fairies episode. And you're going to get a nice, healthy serving of our favorite, what did you call him, smart idiot? That's it. I mean, you nailed it.
Yeah. So, you know, Stoker's got connections. He's got these contemporary stories. He's got possible legends to kind of go off of. He's got a lot of interesting things going on. Let's add to that a little bit of xenophobia. Because, you know, why not just sprinkle that in there? Some argue that Dracula, the monster that he created in his novel, is a response to the waves of Eastern European immigration, which were flooding England in the final decades of the 19th century. And some have studied his original text to detect clues to suggest that in many cases, this villain, Dracula, stands in for the threatening masses of Eastern European immigrants, many of them Jews, who migrated to London. And by the way, he and his wife had moved to London, so he was in England for a great portion of his life. Victorian society at this point was just all flummoxed due to immigrants and, of course, women who were gaining independence. And his was not even the only vampire story written within that decade. Our buddy, Arthur, wrote The Parasite in 1894 about a psychic female vampire who was a self-employed, self-possessed, and sexually self-directed occultist who used her powers to seduce and destroy.
She is my hero.
Yeah.
Okay.
And New Woman, a term that was coined towards the end of the Victorian era to describe women who were taking advantage of newly available educational and employment opportunities to break free from the intellectual and social restraints imposed upon them by a male-dominated society, was really something that they had issues with. They took a hostile attitude towards this, obviously, by writing The Parasite. but there is just the thought at the time in general of parasitism, which is they see the poor, foreigners, the weak, and the infirm. They're sapping power and money from the middle classes. And this also would happen within writing. Doyle wrote The Parasite in 1894, and then we've got Stoker, who published his story just 3 years later. So, I mean, they're kind of borrowing from each other. They have similar ideas. It was this whole group of people who were writing stories that were kind of anti-immigration. They were pro-England. We've talked about that. You guys, we know how Doyle feels. And apparently, well, I can't say apparently. It's thought that Stoker was of the same mind. Now, he spent 7 years working on Dracula, which is a lot of time to figure out the message that he wanted to get across, to find all the right words, to do his research, which he definitely did. There are notes that have been left behind by Stoker that show books and articles that he came across, points that he found interesting. So now let's go ahead and enter Vlad. Here's our history lesson. I hope you're ready. And if we wouldn't mind inserting text-to-speech guy, maybe as a warning, because it's about to get graphic here.
All right, text-to-speech guy, take it away.
While the podcast is already marked as explicit, things are about to get nasty. After all, he is called Vlad the Impaler, not Vlad the Kitty Cat. So consider this an extra caution. You have been warned.
Vlad III was born somewhere in the range of 1428 to 1431. He is the second son of Vlad Dracul. Now, Dracul, while badass, is not a given surname, okay? He took that after he had joined the Order of the Dragon, which was an institution, and I'm quoting here, similar to other chivalric orders of the time, modeled on the Order of St. George. It was created in 1408 by the Holy Roman Emperor Sigismund, mainly for the purpose of gaining protection for the royal family and to defend the cross and to do battle against its enemies, principally the Turks. Now, Vlad was super proud of this achievement. He had coins minted, which show on one side a dragon. He had his personal coat of arms changed to incorporate a dragon. Now, in these cases, the dragon was intended to convey a favorable image drawn from medieval iconography in which the dragon represents the beast of Revelation, who is slain by the forces of good. He took on the nickname Dracul in reference to this induction, and Dracul has its origins in the Latin Draco, meaning the dragon. The land that they ruled and they lived in is part of Romania now, but at that point it was known as Wallachia. Wallachia was bounded on the north and the northeast by the Transylvanian Alps, and then on the west and the south and the east by the Danube River. And it was a really busy trade route. It was constantly under pressure from the Turks and from the Holy Roman Empire. They were free to rule themselves, but they had to pay tributes and work closely, really with both sides, to kind of keep a peace and to keep themselves, like I said, free. Now back to Vlad III. According to local traditions, as a young boy, Vlad had a morbid curiosity in watching, from his first floor bedroom, criminals being led from the small jail cell in the Councilman Square to the jeweler's dungeon, the usual place for execution by hanging. He was a curious kid, I don't know.
Did you say the jeweler's dungeon?
Yeah, that's what it was called.
So they'd like size your rings, replace stones.
What? Hey, maybe space was limited.
I don't know. All right. I just, look, if you had by chance misread something, I wanted to give the opportunity. But all right, jeweler's dungeon. All right.
Jeweler's dungeon. Mm-hmm. He was also apprenticed for knighthood. He learned to swim. He learned fencing, jousting, archery, court etiquette, horsemanship. And he was very well educated by monks and other scholars. He learned Italian, French, and Latin. However, his father, Vlad Dracul, made some political missteps, and he was required to prove his loyalty to the Turks by paying a tribute. He had to swear his allegiance on the Bible and the Quran. He had to pledge 500 boys to join their armed forces. And last, not least, he had to leave two of his sons in their possession for insurance. Now, at this point, Dracula, you know, let's just go ahead. We'll call him Dracula. He was 11 or 12. And his younger brother, Radu, was 7. He was left for 6 years among the Turks. And at this point, he didn't know their language. He didn't practice the same religion. So it was obviously a huge thing for him. But they were treated well, as long as their father, of course, kept to the arrangement. They were educated, they were fed, they were trained. It wasn't, I guess, that bad as far as imprisonment is concerned. But he was also not a very cooperative student and would often receive corporal punishment. And then he was also witness as they trained him and kept him alongside a lot of, you know, their higher ranking officials. He was witness to the effectiveness of the Ottoman use of terror tactics and also saw a lot of the disputes and battles between the Turks and the Christians. So his father, Vlad II, Dracul, he died in 1447. And that freed Dracula and allowed him to try to take over the leadership role that his father left behind. They had a system where it wasn't necessarily just automatic hierarchy. The other nobles kind of would be like, oh yeah, this guy, even the bastard sons, they were kind of given an opportunity where they were like, oh, do you think that you'd be all right? Yeah, we could probably vote this guy. It was interesting. So he was freed. He was able to try to take over leadership, which he did for a very, very brief period of time. It was about 2 months. But then he continued his education. He learned more about the ideals of the Renaissance as they spread into the area. Yeah, the Renaissance is happening at this time. It's crazy because it's like you think about, oh, the 1400s, that feels like so long ago. And it's easy to not think about what was all going on during that time period. So we've got the War of the Roses in England. We've got the printing press. We've got Da Vinci being born. We've got the Ming Dynasty in China. So it's not like this is the Dark Ages. And definitely keep that in mind as I go on and we hear about some of the things he did, because it's like, this guy is horrible. How did he, you know, like not know or not think about this? It must have been such a crazy period of time. But no, this is the start of the Renaissance.
Hey, I'm Char.
And I'm Kelly. And together we host Drinking and Screaming.
We're a new horror discussion podcast based out of Vancouver, British Columbia, where each episode we pair a new cocktail with our movie of the week.
For instance, I'm pairing this ad with just a shot of tequila. You know, because most ads are horrible.
With Drinking and Screaming, you'll find yourself pulled into a new horror film to discuss and a new cocktail to try every week.
Every episode is laced with great soundtracks, theme breakdowns, production trivia, Char's bad drinks, and so much more.
What?
I said clips from the movie.
New episodes every week. Join in on the spoops, Drinking and Screaming, wherever podcasts are found.
I give this ad a 5 out of 10.
You know, we don't rate the movies.
5 out of 10.
All right. Now, it was not an easy go for him at all. There were constant land battles. There were lots of changes in leadership due to defeats, to assassinations. So his allegiance and the region in general really did go back and forth between the Turks and the Holy Roman Empire. And so since he had spent a lot of his formative years with high-ranking Turkish officials, he knew the leadership. And it wasn't until he pledged allegiance to the Hungarian crown and to the Christian cause in 1456, which caused a real rift with his relationship with the Turks. You know, I mean, I guess that's kind of hard to get over when you're trying to expand the Ottoman Empire and the Muslim faith. And this guy is like, I'm going to side with them instead. So at this point, he goes on his own mission. And this is revenge. It becomes very Inigo Montoya of him, because he wants to go after the man who assassinated his father. And after a while, going through many battles, he actually does find this person, and he does kill him in hand-to-hand combat. So now, Dracula, he is in charge. He is ruling this region. He decides to establish his governing center in Targoviste. And it kind of sounds lovely. It's in the foothills of the Carpathians. It's wine country, surrounded by lakes for fishing. All throughout this town center are gardens and Byzantine-style buildings, got homes. It sounds pretty nice, kind of picturesque. And he starts to rule. One of his first steps, though, is by dismantling the power of the noble families. Explaining his way of thinking in a letter, he says, "Think that when a man or prince is powerful and strong at home, then he will be able to do as he wills. But when he is without power, another one more powerful than him will overwhelm him and do as he wishes." Which, yeah, duh. That sounds just basic, like somebody more powerful can come and do this. But it sets the stage for his fear me, don't love me policies. And this is when he starts to go ahead and impale entire families. Now, what is impaling? It is a very, very gruesome form of torture and death, where a wood or metal pole is inserted through the body, either front to back or vertically through the rectum or vagina, and the exit wound could be near the victim's neck, the shoulders, or the mouth. In some cases, the pole was rounded, not sharp, to avoid damaging internal organs and thereby prolong the suffering of the victim. And the pole was then raised vertically to display the victim's torment, and it could take hours or days for that person to die.
The rounded end, I assure you, it's going to do damage.
I don't think so.
Okay.
Lower damage. Now, the evolution of the reputation of him as the ruthless tyrant was due primarily to a series of printed documents, because remember the printing press, and they appeared throughout Europe in the 1480s and the 1490s, which was after his death. But these were preceded by contemporary manuscripts, one of which was a poem by Michael Behaim. He was the Meistersinger, and he actually composed this while Dracula was still alive. It's a poem that is over 1,000 lines long. It was performed at the court of the Holy Roman Emperor Frederick III. And performed, this guy really went for it with how he put this out there. I mean, there was like singing, there were instruments, he really wanted to make sure that people paid attention to what he was saying. So the full title of this is Story of a Bloodthirsty Madman Called Dracula of Wallachia. It's not meant to be absolutely accurate, so much as really a portrayal of the general sense of who Vlad Dracula was and how he acted. Because Behaim didn't actually have any direct contact with Dracula. He had three sources. One was other narratives that had been circulated. There was a Catholic monk who had recently encountered Dracula and lived to tell the tale. And other just current events that people found out about, you know, through letters and word of mouth. Here's a little bit from that poem. And it's not going to be quite as dramatic as he performed it, but I hope that you'll forgive me for that. He asked the assembled noblemen, "How many princes have you known?" The latter answered, "Each as much as he knew best." One believed there had been 30, another 20. Even the youngest thought there had been 7. After having answered this question, as I have just sung it, Dracula said, "Tell me, how do you explain the fact that you have had so many princes in your land? The guilt is entirely due to your shameful intrigues." On top of this, on top of him just kind of wanting to dismantle the nobility, Dracula learned that his mother had been brutally attacked and suffocated. And now he needed revenge for that. This guy loved revenge. So this led to a mass impalement in the courtyard. We're talking like some 200 of the nobles, their wives and families, as well as any others who had been found to have been involved in the murder of his mother. And as he just kind of consolidated power, he had found that some of the nobles had also buried one of his brothers alive. And when they exhumed the body, they found him facing downward. Now, the younger of the noble families, they were actually put to work. They were shackled together and they were marched about 50 miles outside to another area at the base of the mountains. And here he had them work to build a new fortress. And this ended up being Dracula's castle. So then all of these confiscated lands and money from these noble families, he actually offered them and distributed them among the lower class citizens. It seems like a pretty smart tactic, you know, because then now these people would be super loyal because, number one, they saw what he did to the other people. Hello. And then number two, he just gave them a whole bunch of money and land. Now, he was very pro-peasant, I guess. You know, I mean, he realized that they were 90% of the population, and he believed that the strength of the country lay in agricultural wealth. So he was somewhat empathetic to the poor. But he also really was hung up on hard work and avoiding laziness, sloth, that kind of stuff. He wasn't very religious, even though he did take the vow of the Order of the Dragon very seriously. He took it seriously enough to defend Christianity. He had his victims buried with a proper Christian burial and ceremony. He established lots of monasteries, but he was also really suspicious of the Holy Roman Empire expanding into his territory and destroying the monasteries and the chapels that they set up and impaling those monks. It was like he was worried that they were setting up kind of spy areas and that they eluded his jurisdiction. He did not like not having all of the power. But, you know, back to some of his thoughts on the poor and the people who really comprised this land that he was ruling. Well, like I said, he was pro-peasant. I don't know. That's the best way that I can explain it. He wanted to make sure that they were doing 100% that they could do. So there were a couple stories that came out about this and how he handled people who he didn't think were living up to their potential. The first one is that he comes across a man and he's wearing very poorly fitted clothes. We're talking the pants are hemmed up below his knees, you know, instead of actually going down to his ankles. His shirt doesn't fit right. It's all torn and ripped. And Dracula's like, he gets pissed off seeing this. He's like, dude, your wife, you're married, right? The guy's like, I am married. He's like, well, what the fuck is your wife's problem? Why isn't she making you clothes that fit? We have to do something about this. And this guy's like, oh, it's okay. I'm okay. You know, she's pretty decent. And I don't mind that these clothes don't fit. And Dracula's like, mm-mm, no, we can do better. So he goes back to this house. He has the wife impaled and then immediately sets this man up with a new wife. And he's just like, all right, you're going to do better, right? And she does. She immediately makes sure that she's constantly feeding him, making clothes to the point where she almost starved to death because she was so afraid to take time to eat. Now, the other story about how he handled people who weren't living up to their potential is that he gathered the ill, the lame, blind, old, and other vagabonds to a large feast. And they were like, hell yeah, Dracula, you're all right. And he's like, yeah, this is great. You know, I want to take care of you guys. So eat, drink, keep partying. And they did. They totally took advantage of the whole situation. And once they were all pretty wasted, Dracula was like, all right, I'm out of here. He had his servants seal up the hall and set it on fire, letting all of the people inside burn or suffocate to death because he saw them basically draining the economy.
Whoa. Whoa.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah. You hear a couple things. Like, as I'm reading this, I'm like, oh, he had, you know, some decent stances. Oh, maybe not. Maybe not like that. So he had this goal to ensure the safety and security of merchants, and this was done by the use of terror to make sure that thieves and gypsies and vagabonds were not causing trouble, because as I mentioned, this area was a huge trade route. He also had issues with people that he saw as impure, and here is a particularly gruesome passage. You have been warned. If any wife had an affair outside of marriage, Dracula ordered her sexual organs cut. She was then skinned alive and exposed in her skinless flesh in a public square, her skin hanging separately from a pole or placed on a table in the middle of the marketplace. The same punishment also applied to maidens who did not keep their virginity and also to unchaste widows. For lesser offenses, Dracula was known to have the nipple of a woman's breast cut off. He also once had a red-hot iron stake shoved into a woman's vagina, making the instrument penetrate her entrails and emerge from her mouth. He then had the woman tied to a pole naked and left her exposed there until the flesh fell from the body and the bones detached themselves from their sockets. I mean, if you can think of it, this guy did it. There's stories of decapitation, dismemberment, blinding, strangling, hanging, burning, boiling. Skinning people, roasting people, hacking people like cabbage, people being nailed, buried alive, and stabbed. There was forced cannibalism. He tortured people by use of the wheel, hot irons. The list just goes on. But many other rulers actually used similar tactics. Some of these people were in the same time period with him. However, it did get to the point where it was just too much to defend. Even by some of those newly rich peasants, because at what point does it stop? There was just no limit for him. I mean, it was men, women, children, babies that he had no issue with stringing up on a pole and impaling and murdering really horribly. So Dracula actually had three separate periods of time where he was a ruler. There were the 2 months in 1448 that I kind of went over. He also ruled from 1456 to 1462. And then finally, in 1476, for a very, very brief period of time, because he died either later that year or in early of 1477. It's said that a Turk was hired to act as a servant and attack him. There was quite a fight, but he eventually ended up being decapitated and his body was left out for the birds. And his head was put on a stake at Constantinople. There is so much more to Dracula, to Vlad III there, that I could go into, but you guys just kind of needed to know a bit about his life and how horrible he was and that he wasn't a very good ruler. And if I haven't bored you to death with that history lesson, let me congratulate you. For two reasons, really, because you sat through it. But now you officially know more about Vlad the Third Dracula than Bram Stoker ever did.
Okay, because I know that you're probably going to get to this. Because it doesn't sound like Dracula.
It does not, right? So you have to wonder, aside from the setting and, you know, kind of all the blood and...
Well, the name, yeah.
Yeah, you got to wonder, how did he get from point A to point B?
Unless there's something in the lore about Vlad getting bit, then... Yeah, okay, carry on. This is my question. Yeah.
Yeah, so let's go ahead and start with debunking this. First off, Stoker never went to Transylvania or Romania. So, number one, where did the Romania and Transylvania stuff come from? There are actually two works which may have kind of drawn him to the area for the setting. The first is 1849's story, 1001 Ghosts by Alexandre Dumas. And then there's 1892's Castle in the Carpathians by Jules Verne. He ended up referencing a lot of works because, as I had said, he did spend 7 years preparing this novel. So where did he get all this information? One source that he did reference was an article by Emily Gerard de Lazowska called Transylvanian Superstitions. She wrote this for a 19th century magazine, and it was later published as The Land Beyond the Forest. So he ended up getting all of his information from research, kind of piecing some things together. But like I said, it was kind of, oh, that place sounds interesting. Look, this lady wrote an article about superstitions from this time. That kind of sounds interesting. His interest and knowledge of Romanian history and Vlad is, according to one source, sketchy, to say the least, and some of it clearly erroneous. In his notes, there are at least 10 citations from another author, William Wilkinson's account of the principalities of Wallachia and Moldavia with political observations relative to them. This was the first substantive survey of Romanian history written in English. It contained a lot of detail and an historical introduction which referenced Vlad's time period. And there's a footnote on page 19. You'll be able to actually see it in the sources here. And it's, quote, Dracula in the Wallachian language means devil. The Wallachians were, at the time, used to give this name as a surname to any person who rendered himself conspicuous either by courage, cruel actions, or cunning. We already know that's wrong because Dracula came from the Order of the Dragon. So how did this connection get made? Well, it's because there's money to be made off of things. In the 1970s, two men, Raymond McNally and Radu Florescu, decided to go searching because they were like, hey, what's the story behind Dracula? Let's go find Dracula's castle. Let's go ahead and do a Bram Stoker tour. There has to be something there. And I mean, these guys, they did a lot of research into the historical Dracula, to all of his exploits, to the mass impalements. And really, the only thing that connected them was the wooden stakes that he physically used to impale people. And this detail alone was apparently enough for them to prove a connection to vampires. And this really took off because this is the start of, you know, the media environment with kind of factoids and sound bites. Their work, like I said, it really took off. It really set off this whole Dracula is Vlad kind of thing. It's disputed by academic and author Elizabeth Miller, who is noted to be quite an expert on the subject. Her website is really, really terrible, but in quite a few sources that I came across, they're like, she is the person. So here we go. There's a passage that I'm going to read from an essay of hers titled Filing for Divorce, Count Dracula versus Vlad Tepes, which is another title for Vlad the Impaler. I do not dispute that in using the name Dracula, Stoker appropriated the moniker of the 15th century voivode. Nor do I deny that he added bits and pieces of obscure historical detail to flesh out a past for his vampire. But I do vehemently challenge the widespread view that Stoker was knowledgeable about the historical Dracula beyond what he read in Wilkinson, and that he based his count on the life and character of Vlad. While it is true that the resurgence of interest in Dracula since the early 1970s is due in no small measure to the theories about such connections, the theories themselves do not withstand the test of close scrutiny. Yeah. because, as I mentioned in the very beginning, we do have Stoker's notes. So we know the articles that he referenced. We know that he borrowed heavily from Wilkinson, from Lazowska. There are some things where he lifted, and you can actually see almost line for line where he used some of their details and some of their notes. They're almost direct passages and borrowed characteristics.
Get out.
Mm-hmm. And then as far as the Dracula thing, there is a tiny note. It essentially, I'm of course paraphrasing here. Dracula means the devil. And originally he just had the count named Count Vampire, which was actually spelled W-A-M-P-Y-R-E.
How very German of him, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so then once he came across Dracula and figured that meant the devil, he was like, well, hey, that's a pretty baller name. I have to use that. But that's really it. That is the connection. That's where everybody seems to be drawing that Vlad the Impaler as Dracula, because they're like, oh, Stoker researched. He knew. How else would he know about these certain foothills in Romania? And it's because he fucking read books that talked about those foothills in Romania. But then when he got to Vlad, he was like, all right, Dracula, cool, bye. And that was it. That was the extent of that research. There are some people that still try to, you know, push that. But I mean, come on, you guys. If just some of the stuff that I presented to you here doesn't show you that there's not actually a connection, I don't know. I don't know what to tell you. There are some kind of vampy connections to old Vlad. For his last campaign, he had a military advisor who was named Stephen Bathory. He acted as commander-in-chief to the army that was aimed at restoring Dracula to the Wallachian throne in 1476. Now, this guy actually was great-uncle to Countess Elizabeth Bathory, known as the Blood Countess. She ended up being born in 1560, and she was accused of the torture and murder of upwards of like 600 young women and maidens. She would torture them with ice baths. She would let them be slathered with honey and eaten alive by insects. She had tons and tons of acts of torture, and many claim that she killed the women, especially virgins, because she wanted to bathe in their blood to maintain her beauty. Now, just kind of an aside here, the stories of her bathing and using their blood for whatever her ritualistic purposes would be didn't actually pop up until like 100 years after her death. So even her vampire stories might not have as much of a basis as people like to claim. So to wrap things up, Dracula was published in London in May of 1897. Critics were receptive. Readers, they liked it, though, quote, the novel has become more significant for modern readers than it was for Victorian readers, most of whom enjoyed it just as a good adventure story. So it wasn't exactly a huge hit, and it's not like Stoker ended up making a whole lot of money off of it. Towards the end of his life, he actually had to go get a grant from the Royal Literary Fund because he and his wife ended up so poor. And after he died in 1912, his wife tried to make some money by selling his notes and outlines of Dracula at Sotheby's the following year, but she only got £2, which, that's a ripoff, you know, even at that point in time. Interestingly, a guy by the name of Murnau did an unauthorized adaptation, and you've probably heard of it. It's Nosferatu, which, if you've ever seen the costume in that, there's definitely some anti-Semitism going on there. That happened in 1922. It's a silent movie. And Mrs. Stoker, the widow, she was not very happy about this. She took him to court, and this actually renewed interest in Dracula. Fast forward, Hollywood gets wind of this, it catches their attention, and then we get the 1931 movie starring Bela Lugosi, and since then the book has never been out of print.
And gobs of vampire stuff, etc., etc., you know, it's never
stopped. And always, yeah. And you know, I do want to also note, in the biographies that I read of Bram Stoker, it's noted in there that he didn't really seem to have any knowledge of Vlad the Impaler. So, I mean, it's like, it's known. It's put out into the universe, but still this connection prevails. And people are like, oh, that guy who impaled all those people is Dracula. That's Count Dracula. I mean, sort of technically, I guess, with that name, but it's not the vampire Dracula. We need to know this.
And much like, where did Mary get the name? Well, who knows? Who cares? Maybe she did hear it. Maybe she did hear of that castle when she was in the area, but it doesn't, there's no direct, yeah, same thing. There's no direct line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, you know, you got to run with it. There's money to be made. There's Dracula tours and stuff.
And I'm very personally thankful for Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Now, which one? The TV show or the movie?
I thought the movie was great, but the TV show is one of my top TV shows of all time. The writing was so sharp. Just on point for the entirety of it. I mean, everybody's got some meh episodes. Every series does, but consistently, that show just knocked it out of the park.
I honestly don't think I've watched it since it was on TV. It's been a long time since I've revisited that. But the movie.
Yeah, the movie's a hoot.
Oh, God, I love that movie so much. I know I've watched that at least a few times in my adulthood. I mean, it's got Pee Wee Herman as a vampire.
I love that. Anybody who hasn't seen that movie, you need to watch it. Because let me tell you, my mother and I to this day, we can look at each other and go, and then he slumps to the ground and she's talking to, who is it, Rutger Hauer?
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden from the corner you hear, and he slides up the wall as he's doing it, only to slide back down the wall, and then they go back to talking. And
oh my God, the comedy of that movie. It lasts. It lasts.
And R.I.P. Luke Perry.
Oh, yeah.
Hurts my heart.
Oh, man. So, you know, I mean, it's not all bad vampire stuff.
No.
We got some goodies in there. But then sometimes they sparkle.
Mm. Oh, okay. Here I go.
So there you have it. All that you've ever wanted to know. Not really, but, you know, the important stuff. You're talking about bad Southern accents. We watched Knives Out last night. And
he went for the I do declare.
Oh my God.
Kentucky Fried Chicken.
I just was like, you know, because we were sitting there and he's like, what do you want to watch? We don't have any TV. And I ended up scrolling through. I'm like, okay, we're either going to watch Clue or Knives Out. He's like, I don't care. Put on Clue. I was like, well, I want to watch something new. So I chose that. He's like, so you chose Clue too.
So you did. And you also did that wife thing where you asked his opinion and didn't give a fuck.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, just so we're clear. Did you enjoy it?
I did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Here's
was mystery, but there was also a good amount of comedy, and all of the actors and actresses are just, they're great. I mean, I love them all individually.
The reason I haven't queued it up? Old Kentucky Fried James Bond over there. Over there on the veranda.
It's hard. It's really hard. Honestly.
It's a choice, man. He made a choice. And it's like nobody speaks this way. I don't know what this obsession is. Like Gone with the Wind is really the only one where I can tolerate it, because I don't know if it's because everybody's doing it across the board and so my ears get used to it. I think it's more abrasive to me when it's just a couple of characters doing it. Kind of the same thing with Steel Magnolias, though it's glaring when it's somebody in a conversation with Dolly. It's glaringly obvious how bad it, especially Julia Roberts. Ooh. Mm-hmm. And everybody else. I'm not going to point a finger at her specifically. And she's from Georgia. Again, disappoint. Much like with Reese, much disappoint. I don't understand how they couldn't call that up. Maybe it's hard once you lose it. It must be hard. I say all that to say, I can't deal with that fiddle-de-dee. We don't speak that way. And nor do we speak like, God darn. I was riding in the pickup truck and the dog was in the back and lit me up a Marlboro, had some Pabst. I mean, we don't. No,
it's one or the other. It has to be.
Oh, it has to be one or the other. Okay.
It has to be.
It can't be a nice, gentle drawl. It can't.
No, from what I've seen on TV, and everything on TV is real. That's it.
As we've covered. So everybody grab your mint julep and out on the veranda, you can go shock a flatline. As you're listening to this episode and you haven't listened to part one, you have no idea what I'm talking about. So you need to go listen to part one.
A brief interruption. Nash knows full well that some Southerners do speak this way. the dogs and such. Not the veranda part. It's just the principle of the thing. The ladies are also aware none of this has anything to do with the episode's topic. But it's over soon. Let's carry on.
It's okay, look.
Yeah. So, Stoker, his most significant work, his most significant contribution, ended up being Dracula, which may have been an anti-immigration story, and certainly has nothing to do with Vlad Dracula III of Romania. And so that is your fun little tidbit that I hope that you can walk away from this and say, hey guys, the next time someone tries to bring that up as, oh, did you know? And you can say, not today, smart person. That's not how the story goes.
That is what we're here for, is so you can say...
Somebody totally made that up.
Oh God, I was going to say, so you can say you're wrong. But look, you don't even have to be a dick. Just be like, hey, you know, if you're interested in that, you'd like this episode of this podcast that I listen to. And see, let us do the dirty work.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, one last little thing, and it's very, very highly unlikely. I mean, the chances of this are so slim that I almost didn't want to include it. But who knows? There is one verse in the Beheim poem about Dracula that describes him as dipping his bread in the blood of his victims. Then he ate it, and would, I guess, technically make him a living vampire. But to assume or think in any way that Stoker took it upon himself and did not make note of it to read that poem and find out that information, it's extremely, extremely unlikely that he was able to make that connection to create Dracula and the vampire. So I'm just going to leave you with that. I'm leaving you with that one right there.
Well, shit.
Well, shit. All right. So let me ask you about this.
Okay.
As an aside, you said like, hey, let's talk about this in this episode. So I'm going to bring it up.
Okay.
All right. So let's talk about this. I took a class.
Oh, yeah. I was like, what is she about to say? Yeah, yeah, carry on.
All right. So I took this class and it was an interesting look. It was definitely more modern focused as far as, you know, where we went with what we studied. But it was all about serial killers and how they're presented. And one portion of the class was we read Interview with the Vampire. Why wouldn't he have assigned us Dracula or one of these other stories? Anyways, we read Interview with the Vampire. And then we had this interesting discussion about whether or not you would consider a vampire a serial killer.
And I said, no, because I consider them... Okay, let's everybody take off our logic hats. Let's just pretend vampires are real. My thing was that they are a separate species from human, much like, you know, Neanderthal. Are they human-like? Yes, but they're not Homo sapien. It's more like a prey situation, predator-prey.
Mm-hmm.
It's like calling a lion a serial killer of gazelles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could see that.
If they ain't gazelling fast enough, they're going to get eaten.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't really remember what conclusion we all ended up coming to. But of course, it's just something that popped into my head as I was doing this to remember that class. It was such a weird class. Such a strange teacher.
I would imagine. But it sounds like you'd be awake during it. It doesn't sound like it would. It wasn't boring. So.
Yeah, definitely. But yeah, I don't know. I guess if anyone else has a thought on that, I'd be interested. I would be interested in some lively banter.
Lively banter. And talking about, are you done?
Yeah.
Oh, are you done?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, most of my stuff was really about talking about Vlad and how stupid it was that it was connected to Dracula in any way.
Agree. No. You nailed it. Because the more you kept going, the more I was like, he better get bit. He better get bit. Because otherwise, I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
Unless there was some sort of rumor that, people saw him walking around or his body didn't decompose in the way that they thought it should based on their limited knowledge. That's what I kept waiting for. I was like, okay, they're going to say that there was eyewitness accounts of Vlad after he was dead and everybody knew he was dead, but I don't know. Which, honestly, they were so fearful of him by that point, to be sure, that I would believe it if imaginations were running away and they were out of fear, thinking they, you know, that whole seeing him around every corner type of phenomena mm-hmm. went on. That's when I was like, I'll buy it. Okay, but you mentioned, why did he choose Interview with the Vampire? Well, I submit that's a more interesting book than Dracula, but in any event, talking about things, all that's out there about both Frankenstein and Dracula, I was gonna, in the hopes that you all, you know, for the dreaded virus, are not going to parties or hosting parties, I was gonna give you some stuff, some recommendations to binge, watch, or just watch in general. And so my favorite, and Tiff, do chime in, because I did not tell you that I was going to do this very stupidly, like I do, but some good Halloween watches for you. My personal favorite portrayal of Frankenstein is in the first run, because I know that there's now, I've heard that there's a second run going on of this show, but I'm talking about the very first run, and it was several seasons long, of Penny Dreadful. 100% knocked it out of the park, best Frankenstein portrayal and, you know, construction. And I don't mean putting them together. Bad choice of words. You know what I'm talking about? Like character construction mm-hmm. and writing of Frankenstein. Yeah. I've been privileged to behold.
Sorry, me again. Nash means the portrayal of Frankenstein's monster. The Dr. Frank character was good too, but not what she meant. Okay. I'm done.
And then vampire stuff, God, throw a rock, you know, and you're going to hit something. My favorite vampire movie, though, is one called Byzantium, spelled Byzantium. It is excellent. I believe it's like 2012-ish, 2013-ish. Excellent vampire movie. Just phenomenal. And this has nothing. This is just a creepy movie that's very, very good. And the only correlation is the name of it. And it's a movie called Stoker. And again, that one and Byzantium kind of flew under the radar. I know that I stumbled upon them. It was just happenstance. So good chance that many of you might not have heard of either of those. But Stoker, spelled how you think. Penny Dreadful, spelled how you think. And I spelled the other one for you. Highly recommend.
I have not actually seen any of those, so that could be something for me to do.
Well, and like I say, Penny Dreadful's, that's multiple seasons. So, but definitely Byzantium and Stoker are two excellent Halloween movies, in my opinion. And they're not horror. They're not, they're psychological type stuff. But yeah, it's very good.
Nice.
Very unique. They're both quite unique, and to me, at least. So that's it, guys. We hope you enjoyed this Halloween episode. Like I say, you've also got another one in the bank. You can go back and listen to last year's Halloween episode. There was more humor involved. And keep listening for how to get hold of us, so you can get at us on the various social medias and blog, email, all that good stuff. I think that's it.
Sounds about right.
And this is where the catchphrase goes.
Bye.
Thanks so much for listening. As a reminder, you can check out our sources for each of the episodes at show notes, along with any supplemental things we think you might enjoy.
Visit us on our blog at youtotallymadethatup.tumblr.com. You can also find us on Twitter at YTMTUpodcast and on Instagram at youtotallymadethatup. Feel free to contact us on those platforms, and you can also email us. That address is youtotallymadethatup@gmail.com.